Good morning, everyone. It is November 16th, 2021. Looks like December out there. We have so much snow. It's supposed to go all the way away by Thursday, though. This is the ADK Homeroom, your home away from homeroom. It's definitely my home away from homeroom. Had a great meeting with some of my students last night who are competing on our academic team. We're still keeping that competition alive, even though I'm not in the classroom this year due to the pain and the suffering that the mask mandates are inflicting on me and my students. So great meeting last night, and we've got a super topic today. As I alluded to yesterday, this episode might run a little bit longer than usual. Not sure if you will like that or not. Let me know. Try to give me some feedback. Find me at ADK Homeroom on Twitter. You can leave comments at Spotify or Apple, wherever you are downloading this app. ADK Homeroom on Reddit also. That's my username over on Reddit. So today we're going to talk about mind reading. You probably could guess that because I'm sure you are a mind reader. Although you couldn't use Edgar Allan Poe's great technique for reading minds, right? Edgar Allan Poe, writing in 1830s, maybe 1840s, The Purloined Letter. I'm not sure exactly when that story was. It might have been in the 1840s. He churned out top-notch stuff up until his late death in the 1840s. Edgar Allan Poe, he's up there with Mozart, for people that you would like to have had, and John Keats, people that you would like to have had just a few more months of life, because, or even a few more years of life, because Poe was still producing at top level. In Purloined Letter, Poe said the greatest way to read a mind is to look at somebody and let your mind go blank and try to make your posture and your face match that other person's exactly, and then just see what thoughts arise in your head. Huh. Interesting. Interesting. Can't do that over a podcast, can you? So maybe you didn't use that technique to read my mind. I think we can do a little bit better now. It's been, 170 years, something like that, 180 years since he came up with that idea. Let's see how much better we are doing. Let's check in with the world of mind reading. One reason we're doing this is I see a lot of people out there talking about, let's imagine a future world where we have fusion power. Let's imagine this super cheap energy world. Okay. Other people say, let's imagine this world where we have general AI all around, or even we have a lot of specific AIs running around, or we have some military Skynet or AM from I Have No Mouth and I Must Scream. People are constantly imagining things like that. I see them on blogs. I see them in the Twitter sphere, but I rarely see anybody talking about what the world is going to look like and how close we are to this world where everybody can just go around reading each other's minds. And I don't think that the horizon for mind reading, the advent of mind reading, ubiquitous mind reading tech, I don't think that advent is measurably different from fusion or from AI. There's a lot of unknowns in all of these, of course, but I will put it at 50-50 for fusion and mind reading. The tech has made tremendous advances in mind reading, and in some ways it's even easier to see how we go from here to there, from where we are now to a world where you have maybe a handheld device or even a worn device that could just translate somebody else's thoughts for you, as long as they're not, you know, actively defending against it somehow. I can see that world might be, in some ways, even more likely to come sooner than a world where fusion power is everywhere. So today we're going to look at where we are, and I think that this is going to go long enough that it's going to be tomorrow before we get to all the implications of the mind reading technology that could be just around the bend. You never know, right? You never know. Werner Vinge, back around the turn of the millennium, was predicting that the singularity would arise right about now. And I don't see any singularity yet, as great a mind as Werner Vinge is. So you never know if your prediction is going to be accurate. accurate or not. We will talk about where we are, though, and see how that informs our predictions. So let's dig into this. Where is the state of mind reading technology today? Well, a lot of people's first wake-up call to mind reading was this great 60 Minutes special on BrainGate back in 2012. And they had actually sort of done an earlier special on some brain-computer interfaces around 2008, 2009, but those didn't quite impact the public consciousness the way the 2012 60 Minutes piece did from CBS, maybe because YouTube wasn't as popular and people couldn't share the video as easily. Maybe because you didn't have in 2008 this smiling, happy face. It wasn't so dramatic. You just had in 2008 somebody using their brain to type. But then in 2012, you had this amazing piece, right? And here's what happened in this 60-minute piece of BrainGate, which is out in Massachusetts, right? Brown University from Rhode Island and then Massachusetts General Hospital up in Boston. And what you had here was this very photogenic, very telegenic lady, and these researchers had Hannibal Lectered her skull open, right? They just sort of took out the Sharpie and drew a halo around her skull and then just sawed off the top and lifted it off, and they laid this electric mesh on top of her brain. And then they threaded some wires up through out of the mesh through her skull. They drew a little hole in her skull, threaded the wires up through that, placed the skull back on, the top of the skull back on, let it grow back on, and now they had wires going through her skull into this mesh that was laid atop her brain. Grisly, but such is the price of advancement. So these original, you know, these meshes were originally developed for epileptic patients, among other things, because you could put this mesh into a patient with severe epileptic fits, prone to severe epileptic fits, and then by sending signals into the mesh, you could stop the seizures and allow that patient to have a, you know, a fuller, more so-called normal life. Well, they took this mesh then in 2012 in this BrainGate special, and the work had been done really before this, of course, but it finally percolated into public consciousness around then. And instead of sending signals in to stop a seizure or anything like that, they read the signals out. They just allowed the electrodes to read what neurons are firing in the brain. And they interpreted those signals using some pretty darn sophisticated software. And they were amazingly successful. And this woman who had tetraplegia, she was a quadriplegic. She couldn't use either arm, couldn't use either leg. But they hooked these wires up from her brain, from the mesh on top of her brain, to a computer, and then hooked the computer up to a robot arm. And lo and behold, she, this wonderful lady, was able to, just by her thoughts, take the robot arm and bend it down and grab a cup and bring it over to her mouth and get herself a sip of water. It was amazing. Or they could just keep the signals within the computer itself. And then instead of controlling the robot arm, she could control the computer mouse on the screen, and she could play music for herself. She could do all kinds of wonderful stuff, right? So, you know, as I said, this was around 2012, 2008. You had that brain-computer interface at Brown and at New York's Wadsworth Center that allowed, using Jonathan Walpaw's system, allowed you to have a brain-computer interface that would let you type on the computer. Back before that, you had 2002, you had the first inchoate systems like this that were just barely starting to happen. And just a sneak peek in the future, BrainGate, kind of a different niche than a lot of the mind-reading markets out there right now, but or mind-reading products that are out there right now in the market. But BrainGate in 2021, April 27th, in fact, of this year, they just published some photos, and now they're doing it wirelessly. Now the wires are not hooked up to the computers. They still have these protrusions out of this guy's head, right? You can see them in their pictures. They still have these protrusions coming out of this gentleman's skull. you can see them, but it doesn't have to be wired. So that's a huge advancement. Might not seem like much, but the miniaturization will come, and the amounts of data that they're reading out of there and the amount of noise they have to get and sift through to find the signal is tremendous, tremendous. So to be able to do that wirelessly really is good progress for them. But here's the thing. You're probably sitting there thinking, well, that's not mind reading. That's just using some muscle control or reading the muscles. And to some extent, you're right. That in this particular case, this brain gate interface, it's mostly going to the frontal lobe, and it's not reading like you thinking about, oh, it would be great if I could express my love for my family, or it would be great if I could, you know, draw a heart to show them how much I love them. It's not reading abstract thoughts like that and then just drawing a heart for you. No, it's reading the actual commands that your brain is sort of processing as if it were sending the signal to the muscles in your arm. So the person is kind of using their brain to move their muscles still, even though the muscles won't move in real life because they're not there, or the connection to them is severed because of maybe a spinal cord injury, or because it won't work due to a disease like ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease, or what have you. But the brain can still fire those same neurons that would make the muscles move if it was able to communicate to those muscles. And that's the part of the brain that this particular system is detecting. That is correct. So it's not higher abstract order thinking. It's not like we've solved the puzzle of consciousness and we are able to read what someone's conscious mind is contemplating and translate that into, oh, well, this person is thinking about how much they love A&W Frosty Mug. Why don't we put a call over there to the Wilmington A&W and have a Frosty Mug delivered for this person? No, it's not doing anything like that. That brain gate system is looking at the muscles or the signals in the brain that would be sent to the muscles. But that is hardly the end-all be-all of the brain reading, mind reading, brain computer interface scene, as it were. There are plenty of other things going on, in fact. Probably the biggest one to debut over the last decade is fMRI. And this started this functional magnetic resonance imaging, right? I'll go into what that is in a second. But historically, it started getting people excited in 2009. Yukiyasu Okamitani over in Kyoto, Japan, he used MRI to scan brain images of people. Looking, this is going back more than a decade now, like I said, 2009, scanned brain images of people while they were looking at black and white 10 by 10 pixel arrays, right? So he had the people, he put them inside the MRI, right, inside the bat cave there, that cylinder, a lot of loud clunks back in the day, they're quieter now, put you into that MRI and had you look at a 10 by 10 black and white arrangement of dots. And while you were looking at this, the MRI scanned your brain. And then what they could do is afterwards take you out of the MRI machine, let you have a Gatorade, you know, get some claustrophobia worked out of your system, take away those 10 by 10 pixel printouts from your hands, get away from them. Then they would take you, they'd put you back in the MRI machine. They turn on the MRI, so they start scanning your brain again. And they would say, okay, my dude, you who we just scanned, think of one of those arrays. Think of one of those crude pictures that we just showed you. And you would think of it, and they would scan your brain. And then Kamitani-sensei would say, dude, you're thinking of picture number 8. And you would say, yeah, I was thinking of picture number 8. So that's what it was. And that was going back about 12 years now. That's pretty impressive, to be honest, right? They scan your brain at first while you're looking at the pictures, take away the pictures, put you back in the machine, scan your brain, tell you to think of something. And while you're thinking of it, they can scan your brain and tell you which of those pictures that you were thinking of. That is not a trifling achievement. That is pretty cool. Right. And then other people extended this and they did other similar things. Right. Eleanor Maguire over at University College London brought the gaming brought the gaming scene to the mind reading scene, right? Because she had people basically do the same experiment, but they were wandering through a video game environment, right? While their brains were being scanned. And then she would take away the computer, turn off the video game, wah, 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 just like China. You only get 3 hours of video games legally if you're under 18 in China right now. That's so, so bad and wrong. Huh. And they just won the League of Legends World Championships, too, the Chinese team. Can't see that continuing if those draconian measures stay in place. So anyway, just like China, she took away the video game, and then she said, all right, now think of a room that you just walked through in this video game. And you would think of it, and she would be scanning your brain with the MRI, and she'd say, oh, you're in this room. And you would say, gosh darn it, you nailed it. Get out of my head. You nailed it, Eleanor Maguire. And that's pretty impressive too, right? Because they're just moving through the rooms, they're being scanned, and then she takes away the simulation, and she can tell you what you're doing there. In 2012, that Kyoto team struck again, and they could process images while you were dreaming. If they calibrated their machine to you while you were awake, then they could recognize some of those same images in your dreams. Wonder what Taylor Swift would say about her wildest dreams in that situation. I don't know. Then you got another hot spot on the planet for mind reading technology in Ontario, Canada. And in 2012, you had Adrian Owen at the University of Western Ontario. He started doing some interesting stuff on coma patients, people who were vegetative patients. And the vegetative patient, I guess, according to this technical definition, had been in a coma, but had then sort of progressed beyond that and not communicative. And the staff believed that the person wasn't even fully conscious. However, their eyes were open now and they weren't completely in the coma. Excuse me. So in particular, one patient released his name, Scott Routley, and he was vegetative following a car crash. His family thought he was conscious, and they were like, Doc, you gotta work with this guy. He's conscious. He's awake. Help us out here. And all the staff at the hospital said, no, he's not conscious, guys. It's wishful thinking on your part. But then Adrian Owen came in from University of Western Ontario, and he started using these MRI techniques, and he was able to scan and establish a little bit of communication. And according to Professor Owen, he was able to establish that Scott was telling his family he was not in pain. And there was another name not released, to my knowledge, at least in Canada, patient in this study, where he was able to form memories after his coma. And even though he was still in kind of a vegetative state, they would say things. The famous question is they asked him if his niece, if he had a niece or not. And he answered yes, and his niece was born after the brain injury. So that was a pretty big achievement there. Now you'll notice something. So far, all these tests, and we're up to about the year 2012, so far all these tests required that the machine was calibrated to the particular user. You had to have your brain scanned by that machine first. Well, that set the stage for our next big advance. In 2016, see how rapidly this is going. In 2016 at UC Berkeley, they used some functional MRI scans of 7 different people listening to a radio show. And they found out that, or they were able to decipher or decode these people's vocabulary across 1,000 different words just from listening to radio shows without pre-calibrating their machines to those particular 7 people. In other words, they found that all 7 people had pretty much the same neural codes and the same neural encoding system, the same cipher, the same processing across these 1,000 words. And if you had a machine that was working for one, it would work for all 7 in terms of scanning them and figuring out what word they were thinking of or what part of the show they were listening to at that time. So that was a huge advancement in 2016 out of Berkeley, showing that you did not need to pre-calibrate and that the same decoding systems that would work for one would work for more than one person. And that's huge, right? Because if you want to or have, or if you're fearing a future where people can just point a device at you from across the room or even just look at you from across the room and read what you're thinking, that future would require a device or technique that can read your mind without pre-calibration. Because if you're two spies meeting up at a smoky cafe in Paris trying to get some deal done, then and you're trying to get an advantage by reading this spy across the little round table with you with the mushroom candle on it and the cigarette and that long little holder smoking away on the side of the table, if you're trying to get an advantage over them by a mind reading technique, you don't have time to say, oh, could you just lie down in this giant cylindrical bat cave machine for a while I calibrate it so I can read your mind? You don't have time for that. You don't have any pre-calibration, most likely. This could be somebody you never met before. You got to be able to scan them just like that off the bat. So that was a huge advancement from 2016 in Berkeley. We saw that we could, in fact, use the same decoding software on multiple people without recalibrating it new for each person. 2017, over at Purdue, the home of the Boilermakers, Mitch Daniels doing a great job as president of Purdue, by the way, with everything from tuition to research. Absolutely great job. Hats off to Mitch Daniels over there at Purdue. And in 2017 in Purdue, some neuroscientists took the brain scans from people watching movies, and they could state which movie they were watching, again, without having previously scanned that person's brain. Now, one second, there's some animal outside. This is what you get living in the Adirondacks. Let me go help my dog. All right. So I guess I could have just edited that out, but give you a little glimpse, or more likely a little listen, into what things are like around here. We get coyotes, we get fishers, we get turkeys, all kinds of stuff transiting the backyard there. And I don't know what this was. I'm going to have to guess turkey or an owl or something, because I don't see any tracks. And turkeys can fly, if you're not aware, for brief periods. They can flutter and go from tree to tree across from ground to the side of a hill, across a backyard or some distance like that. They are capable of that much. So, Purdue, if you ask me, when they were scanning these people's brains, watching the movies, and then they could state which movie they watched in 2017, if you ask me, that's because they really knew what the movies were ahead of time. If you look at their data, the images they get out of these people's brain scans are really just blobs. And if you had the entire movie library of the world to compare these blobs to, I don't think you could say which movie the person was watching. But since you know it was a movie picked from these 12 movies or however many movies they had in their study, then you can match the blobs up to the movie. So it's not like they get perfect pictures out of these people, brain scans at all. It just really looks like blobs, but you can kind of match them up to the blobs on the movie screen, and they move similarly, and then you can identify the movie that way too. Now, in 2019, getting pretty recent now, you can see more progress from Kyoto, the Kyoto team. And what they had in 2019 is that the person in the study would just see a picture or imagine a picture, just imagine it, and the computer would generate the image being thought of or being viewed, again, with no prior scanning at all, just using a pre-trained deep neural network, a specific machine learning AI application that had been trained on all kinds of different images and all kinds of different people's thought patterns. And then they brought in these new people and just gave them a picture to view or told them to think of something, and they could scan it and they could make some reasonable guesses as to what was being thought of. How reasonable? Well, again, they published their viewing pictures and then what the computer spit out. And unlike the Purdue one from 2017, this one has the colors all right. the colors are in there, and the colors are actually matching the images that the people were thinking of or had previously viewed and then were thinking of. So like they put an owl's face, one of the images shows a brown owl's face in focus against a blurry brown background, and the reconstructed image from the computer, it sort of spits out this brownish object, same color as the owl, against a background that is kind of a greenish background. And to be honest, to me, it looks like a tree stump wearing a mushroom cap in front of one of those backgrounds that are there on school picture day. It doesn't really look like an owl's face, but it at least gets the color right, and it's a similarly sized object against a sort of similarly blurry background. There's a more successful one in here too. There's a leopard one, actually. The leopard actually looks like the leopard picture, which is great. Maybe not necessarily you couldn't tell it was a leopard, but some sort of animal you could tell it was. You can see the eyes and the face and the animalish, the bestiality of the thing, I guess. The image of a goldfish looks like a clam, but it does have some gold in it. There's a stained glass window image, and when the computer reproduced the stained glass window image that the person was thinking of, I mean, the colors are right, and you can see with knowledge after, with hindsight, that it matches up. But if I were just looking at the reconstructed image initially, I'd probably guess it was a book cover or a magazine cover. I'm not sure if I would guess stained glass window. But still, impressive. Impressive. They get the colors right, they get the shapes right, but the textures are off is how I would put that. Interesting. We're getting close, and this is all with functional MRI. And that's kind of the whole hold up here is the nature of functional MRI, right? Peter Reiner, professor at the University of British Columbia, he says that's what's stopping this from broad application, quote, the cumbersome nature of the technology. And I suppose since we're doing a deep dive here today, let's go into what is the cumbersome nature of the fMRI technology. First, I suppose you have to understand the fMRI. It's just the F in fMRI is just not a fundamentally new technique. It's really referring to the thing that's being measured. It's just an extension of regular MRI imaging techniques to measure functional changes, usually functional changes in the brain caused by neurons being activated. So it's not a fundamentally new technique. It's just that we're using MRI to measure a function, something that's actually changing, something that's actually going on in a dynamic process rather than a static process. The reason we can do this is thanks to Seiji Ogawa in 1990. And he discovered that hemoglobin has different magnetic properties, right? Hemoglobin, the binding protein in the blood that binds to oxygen. And it has different magnetic properties in its oxygenated and deoxygenated forms. Namely, when it's deoxygenated, it's paramagnetic. And when it's oxygenated, when it's carrying oxygen, it's diamagnetic. And if you don't remember from your second semester physics course, paramagnetic means that when you switch on an external B field, a magnetic field, when you put the molecule in an external magnetic field, then the internal alignment of the molecule lines up with the external magnetic field, right? And it kind of is attracted that way. Diamagnetic would mean that the internal alignment of your molecule goes opposite the external magnetic field, and so you're repelled, more or less. The poles are repelled. Anyway, so those two states of hemoglobin have different magnetic properties. And as soon as you realize that, you'll realize, oh, because the two different states of hemoglobin have different magnetic properties, they will respond differently in a magnetic resonance imaging machine, an MRI machine. And once you realize that they'll respond differently in an MRI machine, you can capitalize on that to actually generate images that are different from hemoglobin with oxygen, hemoglobin without oxygen, and get these different images and deduce what's functioning. Because your neuron in your brain needs to fire. It doesn't really, the neuron doesn't really have its own store of energy or oxygen or sugar or anything like that. It needs a sudden, significant influx of oxygenated blood to be able to fire this neuron and or this region of neurons, because it's really, fMRI is really only sort of accurate to a region, a regional level, maybe 100 or 1,000 neurons at once. So you see a lot of blood arriving with tons of oxygen to a spot, and then you see it running out of oxygen at that spot. You know that that neuron or that region of neurons are firing, and that's the F in the MRI. It's just the function. It's the change in the brain. It's the thought. It's the firing of the neurons. And of course, if you want a refresher on MRI, basically MRI, and the reason why it's so inconvenient for true mind reading, like if you're that spy at that smoky table in Paris, the reason why it's inconvenient for that is because MRI is a giant machine. It is this bat cave, right? And you go in there and you slide your body in there like your body being slid into the little cubby hole in the morgue or something. And you slide in there and the machine generates a strong magnetic field around you. And then there's another magnetic gradient field that goes across your body too. And your atoms, specifically the fields are tuned to your hydrogen atoms, right? So the nuclei of a hydrogen atom is just a single proton, not even a neutron in there. So really we're talking about a proton. And the magnetic moment of the proton feels a torque because of this external B field, this external magnetic field that's being applied here. And the magnetic moment, the proton swings around to line up with that external field. And it gets in line with the magnetic field. Then what you do, if you're operating the MRI machine, you need this big, giant, clunky machine with the coils all around the patient to establish this magnetic field. And then you pulse in some radio waves. And the radio waves knock the hydrogen protons silly. They knock them out of alignment. And they give them some extra energy that way. But like the rest of the universe, nothing likes to be in a high energy state in the universe. And the protons that were knocked out of alignment, they're at a higher energy state now. They want to decay back to a lower energy state. They want to fall back down to a lower energy state where they are in alignment with the magnetic field of the MRI machine. So as they fall back down, because of the principle of conservation of energy, you can't destroy that energy that they gain from the radio. So they have to release that energy from that they gain from the radio waves. They happen to release it as another radio wave. And that released energy, as they realign with the magnetic field in the MRI machine, that released radio wave is picked up by little aerials and more coils in the MRI machine, little radio antennas in there. And from that decay signal, from the radio waves that are given off as the protons that were knocked silly by the original radio waves, as they come back to realign with the magnetic field of the MRI machine, the energy that's given off, received by the coils, the antennas in the machine, that energy gives you a signal that allows you to build up your image slice by slice of the patient's body. So it takes a long time because you have to go slice by slice, and it takes a big machine because you need this big giant external magnetic field for your protons to line up with. Then you have to have some sort of radio frequency wave generator to pulse them out of alignment. And then you need to be able to detect the energy given off, the radio waves given off as the protons with their magnetic moments swing back into alignment. That's a lot. That's a lot. This is not portable, right? Not portable and not fast. Difficult to imagine how you could be walking down a street in Cairo and scan a rival spy's brain to figure out what they're thinking with an fMRI machine. Now, you never know, right? Advances can happen. fMRI, maybe we will find some way to miniaturize that. It's already made some progress. That's great. But in the meantime, it's important to realize that there are other techniques, other technologies out there other than MRI. And since we are doing our deep dive here, we're going to keep going. We're going to give you the full picture. So what else is out there that's allowing some or facilitating some mind reading or progress toward mind reading besides the fMRI that's made all these waves, ha ha ha, over the last decade? Well, the first one is good old-fashioned EEG, right? An electroencephalogram. This is just those old metal discs that you put onto your scalp and you see what currents come out of them. It's almost the Frankenstein type thing, right? Strap on the headband and see what currents come out. It's actually a pretty good technique. You can get a lot, especially about the sort of broad scale macroscopic activity on the surface of the brain. Of course, they're extremely messy signals, but now we have machine learning, AI. It's really, really good at sifting out the signal from the noise and recognizing many, 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 many different states that could match up to different signals. What is it good for, this EEG type of mind reading? Well, I'll tell you what, Nissan actually has a concept car out. Nissan over there in Japan, they have a concept car, the IMX Kuro, that comes with an EEG helmet. And the driver wears this thing, puts the discs on his head, and the car is monitoring your brainwaves. And the car can actually detect when you want to slow down and when you want to steer the wheel, maybe one way or another way. And by detecting that, right, it can save you a lot of time. For example, let's say, why would you want to save time, right? The human reaction time is about a quarter of a second. So this helmet reading the signals out of your brain, it's going from your brain to the helmet and zipped down into the car. Whereas previously, your brain would have the thought, then it would go to your muscles, and then it would go to the car. And the average human reaction time, do you know? Well, it's about a quarter of a second, right? About 250 milliseconds. Anywhere 200 milliseconds to 300 milliseconds is typical. A fifth to almost a third of a second is average. I always wonder, right, what a pro gamer's typical reaction time is. Some of those guys, incredible reaction. I wonder if it's down to a tenth of a second. I think it is, honestly, just from watching them. But anyway, so in a quarter of a second, if you're right and square and average there, then your car is going 30 meters per second. 30 meters per second is about 65 miles per hour. You know, just real simple math. In a quarter of a second, you travel 7.5 meters, or about 25 feet. Saving 25 feet can mean a lot in an accident, not to mention, right, not just the distance, but the loss of velocity and the loss of energy over those 25 feet when you're braking instead of maintaining your top speed and your top energy over those 25 feet. That can be very impactful. Much smaller impulse that you arrive at the point of impact with, or I shouldn't say it that way, but you would experience a smaller impulse once you have your impact. So, you know, you might not notice it, but that could be a lifesaver, those 250 milliseconds right there that the EEG helmet in the Nissan car is saving you. Okay, right, but that's not sexy, right? It's not just not sexy, because if you saw this helmet, it is definitely not a sexy helmet. It is a nerded out mushroom cap, wire spores, you know, if hair be wires, then black wires grow on her head. I think that's Shakespeare's My Mistress Eyes Are Nothing Like the Sun. So it is not a sexy helmet at all. But also, it's not really sexy mind reading, right? People don't really think about putting on a helmet and the car anticipating your movements when you're thinking about mind reading. So are there other uses of EEG? Yes, absolutely. Right, going back to Ontario at the University of Toronto at Scarborough now, Adrian Nestor and Dan Nemrodov, they were able to do in the last couple of years with EEG what fMRI was doing a decade ago. Namely, they put EEG devices, the metal disc, the Frankenstein headband, onto people, and they would record the people's EEG electroencephalograms while they were looking at faces. And then later, they could put the EEG back on you, say, think of one of those faces that you just saw, and then based on the EEG readings, they could tell you which of those faces you were thinking of. So, right, that's exactly where fMRI was about a decade, maybe 12, maybe 15 years ago at the outside, probably 12 years ago. So EEG, huge advancement there. And it's not anything about the EEG. It's really about the machine learning software that processes those signals you get out of the EEG. So huge advancement there, right? And you can have a lot more research for your dollar with EEGs than you can with MRIs, because it's a lot cheaper, right? And it's also far, far, far more portable. Then, you know, you have these people. There's a really great interview in Frontiers in Neuroscience with Professors Panchakal and Ramakrishnan from the Indian Institute of Science. And they say, you know, there's really certain barriers here, even with EEGs. Now, maybe it's not as cumbersome or as big and bulky as an fMRI. And with machine language interpretation and decoding, we are getting there. We are getting there. But we still have problems. Even though the EEG systems are much faster than fMRI machines, they're still not real time. It still does take a while to process things. And another thing is that in the EEG signals, it's not transferable across people yet. We haven't had that Berkeley 2016 moment where we get a set of rules that allow us to take our pre-trained machines, our scans, and sort of see, prove to ourselves that what works for one person will work for another person with EEGs the way we have with fMRIs so far. Another way here, or another problem, of course, is just that it's limited vocabulary when you're using EEGs, whether you're using it for faces, whether you're using it for words to recognize, words that are recognized by EEGs, whatever you're using it for, you're still using it based on just a set amount of faces or words or movies or video games that you're scanning the brain for. It's not open to the whole wide world as we can do with fMRIs. Still, making progress, and Ramakrishnan and Panchakal in this Frontiers in Neuroscience interview, they state that one day we will have a fail-proof mind reading system. Well, we will see. Now, I can hear you saying EEGs still require a headband or a helmet, right? They're still not like reading somebody's mind from across the room. You can't go slapping around helmets on everybody in the bar to find out which one is the enemy agent. Well, yeah, that's true. You can't go slapping helmets on anybody. So maybe you're thinking, all right, I'm safe. Nobody's going to be able to read my mind. Or maybe you're thinking, bummer, I'm not going to be able to read people's minds in 20 years or 30 years. Well, in both cases, not so fast, my friend, not so fast, because there's another technology useful in mind reading that we have not talked about yet. And that is the pulse oximeter. So you're thinking, pulse oximeter? I know what a pulse oximeter does. How is that any better than a helmet, right? Because we've all seen these pulse oximeters, right? They're those little thimble-like devices that go over your finger during surgery. Maybe you're having a wisdom tooth out or something like that. Or maybe you just need to monitor how well your blood is staying oxygenated, how high your oxygen saturation is in your blood, because you've got some health issues and you need to keep a monitor on things. So you slip that little cap over the end of your finger or your thumb, and it measures your O2, your O2 levels in your blood. Well, okay. And then so you might be thinking, well, I'm not going to be putting a cap on there. We just talked about it. I'm not going to be putting a helmet on everybody around the room. How am I going to go putting around a cap? And how could a cap around a thumb read your brain anyway? Okay, well, yeah, obviously it wouldn't go around your thumb. Let's back up for 1 second. Make sure you understand how an oximeter works, right? So an oximeter works by taking two wavelengths of light at once. Usually it's like one in the red range of the spectrum and one in the IR, the infrared, just a little bit longer waves than red light, not all the way out to, you know, radio waves or anything like that, just a little bit longer than red light. So usually like 650 nanometers, maybe 610 nanometers, somewhere in there, 660 nanometers for the red light, and then like 900 or 910 nanometers for the infrared light. And then what you do is you pass both light through your finger, and then on the other side there's a detector, it's a diode, and it measures which light comes through better compared to the other. Because it turns out that there are different extinction ratios, right, for the different wavelengths of light in oxygenated versus deoxygenated hemoglobin. Going back to Ogawa's discovery, there's some important differences between the hemoglobin carrying oxygen and the one that's not carrying oxygen. So like in the 650 nanometer range, the red light, the deoxygenated hemoglobin extinguishes the light much better than oxygenated. But on the other hand, at 900 nanometers, the oxygenated hemoglobin is much better at blocking the light. So you shine those two beams through, and by seeing which one is blocked more relative to the other, you can figure out what you have more of, saturated, oxygen-saturated blood or oxygen-desaturated blood, unsaturated blood. And that tells you, you know, how well your lungs are doing at getting oxygen into your body, how well your circulatory system is doing at getting that oxygenated blood out to your extremities, things like that. Well, guess what? That's what a fMRI machine is looking for, remember, in your brain. It's looking for that oxygenated blood versus the deoxygenated blood. And a pulse oximeter can get the job done too. Now, there is, in fact, such a device coming out on the market, believe it or not, for actual dollars that you can actually buy. It's a helmet. I'll get to the non-helmet piece in a second here. It's a helmet. It's from the Kernel Thought Company. It's supposed to come out in Q1 or Q2 2022. It's called the Flow Helmet, and it uses a combination of EEG and lasers to pass light. The lasers would be passing the light through your head and detecting the difference between the oxygen-rich blood and the oxygen-poor blood, and deducing things about which neurons are firing based on that knowledge. And like I said, it also has the EEG. So it's a combination type helmet. How much is it going to go for? Well, $37,000 from the basic model, according to the website, and $50,000 to $100,000 for the full version. What can it do? Well, really, it's just going to tell you about the flow of oxygenated blood and deoxygenated blood in your brain. The whole trick, remember, here is the machine learning. And I'm not sure that the software it's coming with is going what it's going to do. We will have to see about the software that comes with. But the hardware, the helmet itself, is just those technologies we discussed, the EEG and the pulse oximeter technology. And clearly it's a transmission. It's going from one side, the light going from one side of the helmet to the other side where it is detected. And it gives you information about the oxygen content in the blood, the oxygen saturation levels in the blood, through that transmission of the two different wavelengths of light through the brain. Okay, still a helmet. I know, still a helmet. But here's the cool part. Here's the key piece here. It turns out that pulse oximetry can also be done with reflection. As reflectance pulse symmetry. So this is difficult. This is much harder than transmitting, right? You put that cap over your finger and the light shines from one side through your finger to the detector on the other side. But it turns out that even though it's much harder, you can do pulse oximetry just by reflecting light off of something. So now you don't need a helmet. Now you don't need a cap. Now you don't need a thimble to go over the thing that you're passing the light through. You just shine the light on something from one side of the room, say, although right now the technology seems to be that it needs to be like almost in contact with it. You shine the light from one side onto something. You don't need anything on the other side. You don't need a helmet. You don't need a screen. You don't need anything on the distal end. You just shine the light in and it bounces right back to you. And that gives you your reading, right? And what's the progress been like here? Well, in 2016, a Korean study found that the accuracy of reflectance pulse oximeters was not good enough for clinical use. However, a lot can change in 5 years, right? And now in February 2021, Sarah Brown, Phil Bickler, Mike Bernstein out at UC San Diego, UC San Francisco, and Physiomonitor, a great company out there, medtech company, they found that reflectance pulse oximeters, the ones that can just shine a light on it and have that light bounce back to you and get a reading on it, those are accurate enough now to meet clinical standards. And not only that, but where are these amazing devices? Where are these pulse oximeters that are based on reflection rather than transmission? Ha ha, they're so hard to find that they're actually in your pocket. They're in your phone. Samsung has these built in, which is amazing. I'm not sure if Apple has followed suit yet or not, because I have a Samsung, and so I follow that market. But your Samsung actually does have a reflectance pulse oximeter in it. I'm staring at mine right now. It's amazing. One's a 660 nanometer light, the other's a 910 nanometer light. And these guys from UC San Diego and UC San Francisco just published in a paper February 2021, just this year, that it's that Samsung reflectance pulse oximeter meets clinical standards. That's a wow moment. Wow. I will say that backwards. Wow. Impressive. That is pretty awesome. So right now, you still have to hold your finger up to the phone. It's not like you can just wave your phone casually and get a reading from this guy across the room. You do have to hold your finger right up next to it, but hey, that's pretty darn good. That's progress. And this is proof of concept of the fact that you won't need to transmit the signal through something. You can just shine it on it, bounce it off, and get your reading that way. Big, big step to go from transmission pulse oximetry to reflectance pulse oximetry. And once you have that reflectance, you're just shining a light on something, it's bouncing back to you, and then you're getting a lot of good information about where the oxygenated blood is flowing, and that can, with the right machine language software, allow you to deduce much information about a thought process. Are you getting scared yet? Maybe not. I mean, if you're a big transhumanist and you're all in favor of this, if you're standing at history's back yelling faster, faster. Remember Buckley, William F. Buckley started his National Review magazine and he said, we're standing athwart history yelling stop. Well, I started this podcast. I'm standing at the back of history, cracking the whip, yelling faster, faster. Also FDA Delenda Est, but you know. So faster history, faster. Let's go. And huge, huge, huge advancement there. Reflectance pulse oximeters with clinical accuracy are now in your pocket, and they do require pretty close to contact, but hey, you never know about the future. You never know, but can distance be too far behind? We'll find out in the next couple of years. Maybe it's already out there. Maybe the spy agencies have this and they are already using reflectance pulse oximetry to scan people from across the room. Who knows? Who knows? Maybe that'll let them solve Havana syndrome. Get to the bottom of that. Who knows? But the point is that it's pretty close. And in some ways, you can see how this is much closer than fusion power. Right? We are getting close. Well, finally, to wrap up here, just to briefly touch on some other things, right? Besides EEGs, besides fMRI, besides pulse oximetry, there are other methods still to pick up noise, to pick a signal out of noise far better than a human can. And again, the key is machine learning techniques. For example, there's an Israeli study from 2018 that uses machine learning in conjunction with a camera that tracks eye movements, and it can make extremely good judgments about whether a person recognizes a face or not. Just from tracking your gaze, it can make those measurements. And I think you probably know, right, there's acoustic hacking for computers where you just have a microphone across the room or even through a wall, and you can listen to the sounds coming from the computer's keyboard, from its hard drive, from its power supply. And you can make really good guesses as to what passwords are being typed, what frequently typed phrases are being typed. You can really do a lot with acoustic hacking. People have to be very careful to prevent acoustic hacking. Even if there's an air gap, acoustic hacking can bridge that air gap. There's thermal hacking, right, where you can get information out of a computer from its heat signatures. Now, it's true computers are not as complicated, at least not yet, as the human brain. But it's hard to imagine a world where acoustic hacking and thermal hacking and eye gazing in conjunction with machine learning and AI, it's hard to imagine a world where that doesn't advance to gleaning at least some information out of the human brain. In other words, it's happening. It's coming. When? I am not sure. But with all these different technologies out there and all of them continuing to advance, and what we've seen about information technology advancements in the last, you know, century and certainly in the last 50 years, it's really easy to see this happening. It's really easy to see mind reading coming around the corner real soon. So I will go back and say what I did at the beginning of this hour, which is that I think there's a 50-50 chance. It's a toss-up between whether we'll get commonplace fusion or commonplace mind reading first. And a lot of people aren't really talking about the mind reading piece. So tomorrow or perhaps Thursday, if we have to, if I am seized by the need for a Poetry Wednesday, then maybe on Thursday, we will revisit and we will have fun contemplating, imagining, prognosticating about what such a future world with commonplace mind reading technology, what it will look like. So in the meantime, between now and then, think about your ideas. Let me know. Twitter, ADK Homeroom, Reddit, same thing. All right, folks, take care.